looking at some of the history of women in Buddhism and the Buddhist tradition. So on the altar tonight, we have an image of Green Tara, and she is one of the most famous images, certainly in Vajrayana Buddhism, from the Tantric Buddhist tradition, and based on a historical figure, was one of those who was instrumental in helping Buddhism to become the state religion of Tibet. She was a hostage bride to Songtsen Gampo, who was the ruler of Tibet at the time. And the other hostage, and she was Nepalese, the other hostage bride is referred to in the tradition as White Tara. And she was a hostage bride sent by the Chinese. And in both cases, it was trying to get the guy to chill out and stop attacking China and Nepal and, you know, making off with all their, you know, hard-earned crops and such. And so White Tara also is sort of admixed in the development of Buddhist iconography and Chinese Buddhism with the figure of Kuan Yin, whose translation of her Chinese name means she who hearkens to the cries of the world, bodhisattva of compassion in Chinese Buddhism as well. And so these are among the best known figures, female figures, in Buddhism, both from the Mahayana tradition. In the Theravada tradition, which is like, you know, much more kind of stripped down, do-it-yourself Dharma, not a whole lot of emphasis on that kind of iconography. Mostly, if you go to the Theravada Buddhist countries, all you'll find is statues of the Buddha. However, there were some truly remarkable women. Very early on, from the very outset, the women who were basically responsible for the Buddha's coming into being in the first place and for raising him, also played absolutely instrumental roles in the decision to include women in the Buddha's monastic sangha pretty much from the time he began to teach. And so what I want to do this evening is to share a little bit of, you know, well-recorded historical background about who some of these women were. Mostly what I'm going to be doing this evening is drawing my comments from a really beautiful book that I recommend to everybody for inclusion in your Dharma library. Author's name is Susan Murcott, and the book is called The First Buddhist Women. Some of you may already be familiar with her writing. So, what this is a narrative commentary, a contemporary narrative commentary, on an ancient set of Buddhist texts called the Theragatha. And the Theragatha, it could be translated several different ways. The one that she uses, for the most part, is Poems of the Wise Women. These were the very first women to join the Buddha's monastic sangha. You know, the first woman to join his sangha was his stepmom, about 5 years after he began to teach. And so he individually admitted women into the sangha from very early on. When it was done formally is, you know, something I'll speak about in just a few moments. So, the Buddha, even by the standards of the time, had a slightly checkered past insofar as women were concerned. And now I'm not seeking to disparage present-day Hinduism at all. At the time of the Buddha, it was about 1,000 years after the Aryan invasion, and there had been, the Aryans had this extremely patriarchal, extremely hierarchical system. You know, they imposed the caste system. They had a very conservative form of understanding of how Brahman and Atman, you know, the eternal within each person, achieves unity with the Godhead, you know, with the ultimate reality, the ultimate being, Brahma. And there, the way they taught it, you try to get, by merit, good deeds, get reborn through the various castes until you attained, you're born into the Brahmanic caste. And then in order to achieve ultimate union with Brahma, you needed to take a male form. And so when the Buddha was kind of debating with Ananda as to whether or not women could come into the Sangha, the Buddha was, what happened was his stepmom came to him, and since she had become so wise and achieved awakening, many of the women in their clan, the Sakyan clan, would come to her for aid, for assistance. Among the women who came to her were ones who were widows from a big battle that the Sakyans were fighting with a neighboring clan over water rights to a nearby river. So there were a lot of people, a lot of men slain in this, and so we had a lot of war widows who had no means of support and were in very dire straits. Other women who were really in kind of rough shape was the Buddha's harem. Being a person of his caste and of influence, you know, the power of his family as rulers of the Sakya clan, men of that station in that time would have not only perhaps multiple wives, but also maybe a consort or two, and then a harem that, you know, the consorts within the harem would actually get paid a salary. The rest of the women in the harem were basically slaves, and their job was to gratify all of the sense pleasures or sense needs of the men that they belonged to. And so the Buddha had actually about 12 women in his harem, in addition to his wife who bore his son. And even though they were for the most part slaves, chattel, you know, part of the tradition was that, for instance, when a male person of similar rank came to visit, you know, offering one of the members of his harem for the pleasure of the visitor was part of the custom. Any woman who deigned not to follow orders, whether it was that one or another one, could be subjected by punishment up to 1,000 lashes. So it was a pretty rough way of life. When the Buddha left home, he was a deadbeat dad, abandoned his wife and child, went off and spent 6 years in the boonies, you know, becoming enlightened. In addition to his wife kind of getting left high and dry, the entirety of his harem lost their identity as well, and they lost all influence, and they basically became impoverished. So he had, you know, generated some not altogether wholesome karma during this whole process, one might say. The way the Buddha literally came into being is that there were two women, Prajapati and Maya. They were sisters, and both of them were married to, you know, their families married them to one of the chiefs of the Sakya clan, who was the father of the Buddha. Maya was the first to become pregnant, and she was traveling late in her term to be with her family to give birth, which is what they did, but she didn't quite make it, so she gave birth on the side of the road to the son, Siddhartha Gautama, and a few days later she died. Her sister, Prajapati, took over as the Buddha's mom. She already had, you know, by that time, she had some children, and she took in the Buddha and raised him as her own in a very loving way. And so his very existence had been dependent upon the sisters, Maya and Prajapati. The Buddha, when the Sakyans got in this battle with this other clan, came and gave a very inspiring sermon that caused the fighting to cease. So in addition to all of the men who were killed in the battles, many of the men who heard the sermon became quite moved and quite inspired and became monastics. They all went to follow the Buddha, abandoning their wives, of course. So what this left was a very large dependent population of women who were in extremely dire straits. So Pajapati went to the Buddha and said, this isn't in Susan's book, not in so many words, but dude, there's a lot of women out here who are hurting a lot, in part because of your actions. And they've been coming to me, and the number, the classic number is 500, this big group of women who are in dire straits, destitute. They've been coming to me for counsel and advice. I've been teaching them the Dharma. They're very committed, they're very sincere. And I think that it would be a wonderful gesture should you simply allow them into the monastic sangha. And so the Buddha refused. There's a lot of speculation about why he refused. He had been letting women in on an individual basis, starting with his stepmom. Some of the theories are, number one, he was just misogynistic, like the rest of the society at the time. Another is that he was trying to do things much more incrementally, and he was concerned about letting so many women in at once because he didn't trust his own sangha, that it was not a real mature sangha, and that some of the monks were really struggling with their vows to begin with. And he was afraid that he couldn't protect the women if he brought them into the sangha, that they were going to be vulnerable to misbehavior on the part of the monks. So they're among the reasons that have been thrown out there. That's among them. So he said, no, I don't think so. And she was, quite upset and went away crying. And then Ananda, his sort of wingman, his sidekick, his attendant, came to him, and he was very moved by Pajapati's request and the plight of these women. And he said to the Buddha, in your view, are women capable of realizing enlightenment? And he was basically asking, do you see things the way the Brahmins do, which is you need to be born male before you can become enlightened? Or can women become enlightened as women? And he said, yes, Ananda, they are able to do so. So then Ananda says, well, if women then are able to realize perfection, and since Pajapati was of great service to you, she was your aunt, nurse, foster mother when your mother died, she even suckled you at her own breast, it would be good if women could be allowed to enter into homelessness. And the Buddha, refused. And upon Pajapati had already been ordained, she comes again to ask the Buddha, will you reconsider? Look at how these women are suffering. And he said, no, I just don't think it's the right thing to do right now. I can't pull it off. And she went away crying once again. And then the Buddha took off on his kind of road circuit around northeastern India, headed off to another town to give some teachings. Pajapati went back to the women who had been awaiting the possibility of joining the Sangha. And they all cut off their hair and they took robes, they fashioned robes for themselves just like the male monastics did. And they walked 150 miles barefoot to go to where the Buddha was. And she went to the Buddha, basically not taking no for an answer. And when the Buddha saw the devotion of these women, that they had been willing to undertake such a sacrifice, kind of literally put their lives on the line, he saw their sincerity, and he understood that their integrity, you know, they're willing to literally risk their lives for the possibility of living a life that might result in enlightenment, that he allowed them in. And again, we get into kind of various different historical, you know, kind of slants or takes on it. It's pretty obvious that a very substantial portion of the Buddha's male monastic sangha was very strongly opposed to allowing women in. So evidently one of the compromises, what he said, all right, we're going to let them in. However, the most senior, most awakened of the nuns shall be, insofar as the organization of the sangha is concerned, junior to the most recently admitted male novice. And in Burma and Thailand, at least, that's still how they run the monastic sangha. And I told you, a few weeks ago, I guess, about one of the teachers who had a real impact on my practice of the jhana, deep samadhi, is this very, very skilled teacher, Sister Dipankara. She was a 10 precept, a novitiate, basically. And Westerners, she made a couple of trips to the West, and a lot of the students had contacted her, like I were extraordinarily moved and touched by her teachings, went to Burma to the Pak Monastery to receive teachings from her. And she was not allowed to offer teachings within any of the buildings at the Pak Monastery, because there were monks under the same roof. And so the only way that she could convey teachings was to meet outside in a courtyard. And so all these Western students, instead of going inside and hanging with the monks and, you know, chanting and whatnot, they sat with Sister Dipankara out in the garden, you know, so she could offer teachings. And that did not sit well with the others in the Pak Monastery, and so she moved on not very long after that. But so it continues to be, you know, kind of an artifact of history, but that continues to be the way they play the game in Southeast Asia, which is why there, you know, basically there are so few women Westerners who take robes, although, you know, some certainly do. So that harkens back all the way to the Buddha's time. So with these additional strictures and rules, the women were allowed into the sangha, the monastic sangha, and began to obviously have a very substantial impact on how the Dharma was conveyed. Not how it was conveyed by the Buddha, but how it was conveyed interpersonally. We have these really ancient texts going, you know, they're just about the same age as the Pali Canon itself. You know, these texts that are the poems of these women who achieved enlightenment, who awakened. And what they are these very personal poems where they tell the story of their awakening. The impact of this literature over time has been quite profound within Theravada Buddhism. The poems in Susan Murcott's view were written for a variety of purposes. She thinks that many of them are actually written to other women, basically saying, this is possible. I did this. You can too. So they were written as sort of inspiration. Okay. But not only to other women, but to the members of their cultures at the time. which was kind of a declaration in poetic form. Yes, women are just as capable of following the teachings of the Buddha to ultimate freedom as the men are. Okay. And the poetry that they generated in the process has become, you know, one of the most powerful affirmations of that fact from the time that they were first there. And Susan writes, we can consider Pajapati and her sister Maya, whom Pajapati mentions in the closing stanza of her poem, as the great mothers of the Buddhist tradition. For Maya, mother of the Buddha, this is an obvious designation. But it is also equally appropriate description of Pajapati, who through countless lives had come to know all relations, mother, son, father, brother, grandmother. Maha means great, because there are several women after we took the same name. Pajapati Gotami is clearly an old soul. She contains within herself the breadth of experience that makes her the appropriate founding mother of Buddhism. This is her poem. Homage to you, Buddha, best of all creatures, who set me and many others free from pain. All the pain is understood. The cause, the craving is dried up, the Noble Eightfold Way unfolds. I have reached the state where everything stops. I have been mother, son, father, brother, grandmother, knowing nothing of the truth I journeyed on. But I have seen the Blessed One, this is my last body, and I will go no more from birth to birth again. Look at the disciples all together, their energy, their sincere effort. This is homage to the Buddhas. Maya gave birth to Gotama for the sake of us all. She's talking about her sister now. She has driven back the pain of the sick and the dying. So, it's the Buddha's stepmom. Patakara was an extraordinary woman, one of the most powerful personalities in the early Buddhist community. Pieces of her history have been lost or confused with those of other nuns. But she was to become a skillful and charismatic teacher. She was born again to a wealthy, rich family, and there was an arranged marriage to someone of her rank and stature. But she actually developed a relationship with one of the servants in the home, and they ran off, they eloped, and they got married, and she became pregnant. As her pregnancy drew to term, again, she was wanting to travel back to her family to give birth. And they had a child. And then she got pregnant a second time. She was traveling back to give birth, have the child. And her husband this time came with her. He hadn't been too cool on going back and visiting the king that his daughter had stolen. So this time they came to, they were headed back to the old, to her family. And it was raining really hard, and they were setting up camp, and he went off into the bushes to cut some cane to create a little dwelling for them, a little shelter. And he got bit by a poisonous snake and died. He never came back. She thought he'd run off. The next morning she got up. She had ran into this situation where she wound up delivering on the road. So she had this infant and she had her young son, and they were trying to get back to her family, and came to this raging river that she couldn't take both kids across at once. So she told the alarm to stay there, cross the river with the infant, put it down on the bank, started back for her son. A huge raptor comes along, picks up her baby and carries it off. She starts screaming about that. Her son on the other side of the river thinks that his mom's calling him, tries to get in the river, drowns. She goes now with her dead husband and her two kids dead, starts off anyway for her home, and is approached as she's coming into the village by somebody. She asks about her parents. The guy says, "Don't ask." And she said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, in this raging rainstorm, their home, the roof collapsed and killed them." Okay. So at that point, she goes stark raving mad. You know, she just goes insane with the grief and starts wandering around and tearing off her clothes and being crazy, and no one will have anything to do with her. And she is wandering around mad and encounters the Buddha. And the Buddha says, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." And somehow all of a sudden she does. And she says, "Help me. Help me," she said to the Buddha, and told him her terrible story. You know, he could alleviate people's pain, said, "Please make my pain go away." The Buddha replied, "Patakara, don't think you have come to someone who can help you. In your many lives, you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the four oceans." This made her grief less heavy. He went on to say that when she herself went to another world, no kin could help, that even in this world, no kin could help. There's no one else she could rely on to bring her suffering to an end. And he spoke of the Buddha's path. When he had finished, she asked if she could be ordained. Together they went to the community of nuns, and she was accepted. Patakara's poems recount the moment of her enlightenment experience, which took place later. Few poems in the Theragata are so precise in describing the moment. We see a sequence of events familiar in the Buddhist contemplative tradition, a period of intense concentration, relaxation after the concentration, and a catalyst from outside, the going out of the lamp that sparks her breakthrough. Her poem reads, "When they plow their fields and sow the seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell. I checked the bed and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed." So what she's saying, when I read these poems, you know, it sounds to me, I get the same feeling as I do when I read the 8th century poetry in Xuan Buddhism, you know, like the poetry of Lipo or somebody. It's like sort of Zen-like, right? Because what she's talking about here, you know, she says, "I've done everything right. I've followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud." Basically, why am I not enlightened, right? So she's saying, I've done everything by the book, you know, sort of mastered the teachings and followed instructions with the expectation that I was going to be awakened, and yet it hasn't happened. So there is the striving that she's discussing, that she's talking about. And then what she describes is that she came fully into the present moment, absolutely present. No thoughts, no striving, no wondering why she hadn't gotten enlightened yet. With her concentration focused just on the moment, just on the microscopic movements that she was taking, the very things that she was doing at that moment in time. "Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope." all that arises must pass away, the flowing, you know, of this water being spilled out, flowing down the slope and disappearing. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse, right? To just be with the moment in this very, very patient, peaceful way. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down, which is to say, she was extinguishing the wick on the lamp. And she says, when the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So just that act, you know, it's like the flame had been her desire, her craving, you know, for freedom. And she extinguished the flame. And when she did that in the physical world, suddenly she realized in her mind that that's what she needed to do as well. Just extinguish the desire, even the desire for enlightenment. Let it go. And in that moment, she became free. So these women generated this remarkable poetry that told in these very kind of intimate, personal, experiential ways what it's like to become free. And, you know, we're left with some wonderful literature as a result. See if there's a couple more we can share. There's another one. Uttama among Pitaka's disciples. The Buddha taught seven factors of enlightenment. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. I have found what is vast and empty, the unborn. It is what I have longed for. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, finding joy and peace. I have ended the hunger of gods and humans. And I will not wander from birth to birth. I have no thought of becoming. According to the Terigata commentary, for Pitakara was watching water trickling from high to low ground and then disappearing, the letter to see the transitory nature of all life. For Mitakali, one of her students, it was seeing the skandhas, the elements of mind and body rising and falling away, that led her to realize things as they really are, impermanent. Although I left home for no home and wandered full of faith, I was still greedy for possessions and praise. I lost my way. My passions used me, and I forgot the real point of my wandering life. Then as I sat in my little cell, there was only terror. I thought, this is the wrong way. A fever of longing controls me. Life is short. Age and sickness gnaw away. I have no time for carelessness before this body breaks. And as I watch the elements of mind and body arise and fall away, I saw them as they really are. I stood up. My mind was completely free. The Buddha's teaching has been done. So, kind of sweet stuff. Has anyone else read these texts? Any thoughts about that? Or early women who wisdom? Please, Luke.
I have a book from the Vajrayana tradition that is like that. It's the Songs of Enlightenment, you know, that really talks about specifics and they're really their poems.
Poems of women in the...
No.
Yes, the Terragata. There are similar collections of the male monastics as well. The remarkable thing about the Terragata is that it exists at all. That these poems were composed, that they were recorded, and they immediately became part of the Theravada literature, basically because they're just so inspiring.
So these that I'm familiar with have definitely inspired me. And
yes.
One thing I was going to ask you about, when you talked about the two ransom brides, I was wondering about Yeshe Shogel, Padmasambhava's primary consort. And
yes.
I don't know the history, but I mean, when I read the teachings from that tradition, it's about Yeshe Shogel, his primary consort, who he transmitted the teachings to.
Yes.
And then she transmitted them, to people.
Yes, right. I think she was the daughter of a prince or something, noble, and that they sort of eloped, right? That she ran off with him.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
She was referred to as Skagit.
Yes. Yeah, but became essentially his partner, and he, the first one to whom he transmitted the teachings, and then so she became a vehicle for transmission as well. Yeah, good. Okay. Any other thoughts or reflections or comments? Please.
What became of the Buddha's wife, or Siddhartha's wife?
Yudhara, she eventually signed on as well. She became a follower of the Buddha, as did their son, later in life. She didn't want much to do with him when he first came back after his enlightenment. And so rather than going forth to meet him when he came back home again, she sent their son instead, who he had named Rahula, which means fetter. So he felt fettered. Rahula joined the monastic Sangha, but he was always giving him advice, and evidently, as one might expect, he and Rahula had kind of a up and down relationship. But eventually, Siddhartha joined as well, became part of the Sangha. Okay, so before we go this evening, there's a Sangha member wrote me a little while ago and said, there's all this stuff in the news right now about the Rohingya in Burma. And, how could such a thing happen in a Buddhist country? One of the countries that's kept alive this tradition for all these years. And it's a very good question. I really reflected on it for a while. And when the thoughts that came to me, and because I was watching in horror as I've been seeing this basically genocide going on in Western Burma as well, and these masses of refugees flowing across the Burmese border into Bangladesh. Certainly from the time of the founding of the Holy Roman Empire, Germany is a devoutly Christian country. Right? It's the birthplace of the Reformation. Right? And in this devoutly Christian country, in the middle of the 20th century, that country set out to exterminate 6 million people. Tried to wipe Judaism off the face of the earth through mass murder. Devoutly Christian country. Right? So we don't talk about that as the Christians exterminating the Jews. We talk about it as the Germans exterminating the Jews. If you're watching this series on Vietnam, the United States is a good Christian country. We sent people over there to do God's will, right? When I was over there on this Christmas of 1966, we had this this kind of amphitheater dug into the hillside in Da Nang, the seaport where I was stationed at the time. And we had the succession of people come to visit. We had Billy Graham, the Baptist minister, came and he talked to us. And his message to us was that we should not lie with native women. We need to keep ourselves pure for our wives and sweethearts back home. Then we had the Bob Hope Show. And then we had Cardinal Spellman from the Diocese of Chicago, a self-described warrior priest. His message to us was that we, you know, for those of us who had qualms about killing our fellow human beings, you know, which Jesus was actually kind of down on, just like the Buddha was, you know. He said we should not feel badly about so doing because these were godless communists. They were enemies of the true faith.
Yeah.
I read in a book, and it was very popular, the whole point was, that's why this is really bothering me, that Buddhism was the only major religion that never had, like, the armored Christian soldiers, the crusades and so forth.
Right.
The only religion that never had wars fought in the name of...
Yes. Yes, that is true. That is true historically, right? Yeah. Well, in so far, it's an excellent question. You know, I guess it was the 10th, 11th century, when God evidently commanded the West, you know, the Roman Catholic nations to retake the Holy Land, right? And so they initiated the Crusades with the purpose of liberating the birthplace of Jesus, but maybe opening up some trade routes and grabbing some real estate along the way and whatnot. Didn't go well, of course, as we know, over the long haul. But it sort of gave the people in the Middle East an idea. And they said, well, damn, you know, if the Christians can do it, why not us? And, you know, the Prophet Muhammad only ever talked about, you know, using violence defensively, but they decided to take off and do crusades of their own. So they invaded the Indian subcontinent. They really had it in for Buddhism. So they pretty much destroyed Buddhism as one of the state religions, and it's really never recovered since then. They invaded Southeast Asia. They got as far as Spain, you know, in the West. And so people have long memories. You know, when there are places throughout Southeast Asia where there is still friction, you know, between the Muslim populations and the Buddhist populations. In Sri Lanka, you know, the Tamil Tigers were really going at it with the Buddhist population there. You know, terrible bloodshed. When we were in Thailand, I was on sabbatical in Thailand, we're down in the maritime provinces of far south of the country in Yala province. And what was going on down there is that in Thai education system, everyone has to wear a uniform up through undergraduate in the university. So no headscarves are allowed, okay. 40% of the population in the southern provinces in Thailand are Muslim. And so there is terrible strife going on down there because it felt like that they were really kind of being oppressed. And we were out, we did a kayaking expedition through the mangrove swamp national park down there, and our guide was a Muslim. And so we asked about this because what had been going on right in Yala province, the south of us, is there had been Islamic extremists, you know, who were like, they'd drive down the street, two guys on a motorbike, and one of them in the back with a machete, and hacked to death a policeman, and they hacked to death a teacher, and so there were these assassinations going on, terrible strife. It wasn't anything the Muslim population supported or thought was a very good idea, but it was inflaming these tensions. And he said, well, you know, we've only been we've only been part of Thailand for 200 years, you know. His people have been there for like 1500, so they felt like a conquered and oppressed people. So those kinds of tensions have been going on for a long time. The Rohingya have been living in Western Burma for hundreds and hundreds of years in relative peace. And people are saying, well, why can't Aung San Suu Kyi do something about this? It's because she has no power. You know, when push comes to shove, the country is still run by the military, by the military junta. And they're the ones that are committing the genocide. And they're the ones that are driving out the Rohingya, burning down their villages, claiming their real estates. So there is, you know, it's definitely ethnic purging that's going on there. Yeah, please.
Do you know what the Hmong response to this whole crime? I mean, I'm sure it's...
Say what?
I'm sure it's very diverse, or at least it can, you know, there's probably some people there for it, but overall, do you know what the monks, what their role in this, you know, because I know there's a big differentiation between the lay people and you know, the ordained in a Southeast Asian. You know,
right. You know, how Burma got to the place it is now, you know, they'd had elections, and Aung San Suu Kyi's party won, and then the military just took over and imprisoned her. And it was like that for the better part of 20 years. And then the pressure began to grow again and there was a lot of, you know, international pressure put on the Burmese junta to kind of back off a little bit. And then the next wave of nonviolent revolution began. It was, to a significant extent, led by the monastic sangha. So we had, you know, the monks and nuns from all the monasteries just going out into the streets, called a general strike, pretty much shut the country down for a while. How the junta responded was they imprisoned and tortured a lot of the monks, others, hundreds of them, and they did this, you know, and made a big public show, but they'd line them up against a brick wall, smash their heads against the wall and fracture their skulls. And then just leave them kind of writhing in pain and not allow any medical assistance for them. So about as brutal as you can get. You know, so the monastics were kind of in the forefront of helping bring about the changes that have occurred to the point that they have. So, you know, the news media loves to make everything into a kind of a religious war. You know, it's kind of NFL, you know, it's the Buddhists against the Muslims, and let's watch them. Not so. Not so. You know, it's just as radically opposed to everything the Buddha taught and stood for as what the Third Reich did was to the teachings of Jesus. You know, it's what happens when the power of hatred, you know, runs rampant, you know. Attachment, aversion, and delusion, greed, hate, and delusion. You know, those forces are, you know, rampant in that country right now. And it's a great tragedy. But if anyone asks you how could such a thing happen in a Buddhist country, you can bring up the Third Reich. You can bring up, you know, what happened in Vietnam. That kind of radical, violent racism has absolutely nothing to do with any of the teachings of these great wisdom masters. And, you know, so then you ask, well, then how, if the religion has so little influence, you know, what good is it, sort of, you know? The world is watching, and what I'm hoping is that more Buddhist leaders in the West can begin to become more vocal as well. And say this is unacceptable. You know, if this junta cannot stop what it's doing, then we need to rethink, you know, improved relations with them in the first place. This is not a way that we should be living together in peace in this world. Well, my good friends, here we are. Another 2 hours down the pipes. Let's. Take just a moment, if we can, sit together quietly.
Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Buddha Nubhavena Sata Soti Bhavantute. Through the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Dhamma Nubhavena Sata Soti Bhavantute. Through the power of all the Dhammas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. Through the power of all the Sanghas, may you always be well. May you live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May you open to the joy within you and be happy. May you rest in silence and stillness, at peace with things as they are. May you awaken and be free. I'm on the road for the next 3 weeks. I'll see you on my return. Have a safe journey home.